Greetings and trivial generalizations, my boisterously microthalmic listeners, and welcome to this March 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this lecherously algophagian science podcast segment, Jim Campanella.
Hey, how are ya?
Frankly, not so hot. I'm still recovering from two straight weeks of influenza. And after this, I understand entirely how the Spanish flu pandemic killed tens of millions in the early 20th century. I'm still deaf in my left ear because my Eustachian tube refuses to drain. But that seems a small price to pay to be getting healthier. And no, this year we stupidly did not get vaccinated. See, you pay the price for the decisions that you make. First story of the night. Humans have pretty good color vision, especially compared to many big animals like canids. But by butterfly standards, we are complete pikers, who just see a few million different colors. Dr. Ken Arikawa of Sokendai Graduate University for Advanced Studies in Hayama, Japan, reported in this month's Frontiers in Ecology and Evolution that the common blue-bottle butterfly has the most advanced color system of any organism yet studied on Earth. They not only have the sharpest vision in the world, but the most sensitive to color shading. It turns out that the common blue-bottle butterfly from Australia, called Graphium sarpetum, is known for its conspicuous blue-green markings, but it has extreme color vision. Arikawa reports that each of their eyes contain at least 15 different types of photoreceptors. Those are the light-detecting cells required for color vision. And these are comparable to the rods and cones found in human eyes. And to understand how complex, spectrally, the retina of the butterfly actually is, researchers used physiological, anatomical, and molecular biological experiments to examine the eyes of 200 male blue bottles that they collected in Japan. They only used males because apparently they couldn't get enough females. Anyway, they found that different colors stimulate each class of receptor. For example, UV light, ultraviolet, stimulates one, while slightly different blue lights set off three others, and green light triggers four more. Arikawa says, quote, "Our intracellular electrophysiology studies reveal that the blue bottle eye contains photoreceptors of 15 distinct spectral sensitivities. These can be divided into six spectral receptor classes, ultraviolet, violet, blue, blue-green, green, and red-sensitive. The B, G, and R classes respectively contain 3, 4, and 5 subclasses. 15 is the record number of spectral receptors so far reported in any organism, insect or otherwise," unquote. Most insect species have only 3 classes of photoreceptors. And even humans only have 3 cones, and even we see in millions of colors. Butterflies need only 4 receptor classes for color vision, including spectra in the UV region. So why did this species evolve 11 more? What can they possibly be using that level of color sensitivity for? Well, you can bet they are not amateur artists on the side producing art to sell at sidewalk sales. In the paper, Arikawa says he suspects that some of the receptors must be tuned to perceive specific things of great ecological importance to these iridescent butterflies, such as sex. For instance, with eyes alert to the slightest variation in the blue-green spectra, male blue bottles can spot and chase their rivals away, even when they're flying against a blue sky. Or, for that matter, they can find females much more easily, and apparently, since they had so much trouble catching female butterflies in this study, they must be pretty hard to find. Anyway, it always seems to come down to sex, doesn't it? Why do guys become rocket scientists and work for NASA? Well, obviously because of the huge bevy of beauteous, gravid females that chase them around trying to win them for husbands. Must be tiring for those poor NASA guys. I mean, how can you ever get finished with building that rocket at JPL with all the women at the gate howling your name? And obviously somewhere down the line, the women realize that all botanists look amazing like Matt Damon. And let me tell you that it's been a real trial for me since The Martian came out. I've been beating them off with a stick, reminding them I'm married. Okay. I hope you realize I'm kidding about all that. But there is this tendency among biologists to explain things simply by sex. I mean, it's a Darwinian thing, and I understand it, but I think it gets a little carried away sometimes. All right. Second story of the night. Well, let's stick with sex. Dr. Xianhua Tian of China Agricultural University in Beijing reports in this week's Proceedings of the National Academy that offspring conceived by in vitro fertilization, IVF, are much more likely to be male than female. This weird, skewed statistic has actually been known for quite a while among IVF scientists and doctors and has been unexplained. But Tian has come up with an answer in his work with mice. X chromosome inactivation seems to be a major culprit here. X chromosome inactivation turns off the extra chromosome in animals so that males and females make the same level of X chromosome proteins, so females don't have twice the amount of protein being made as males. It's an important process to keep homeostatic levels of those regulatory enzymes controlled in females and not double them up. So Tian found that turning off the female embryo's extra X chromosome is responsible for much of that sex ratio skewing in mice and humans. The team also demonstrated a method of reversing the male dominant ratio by modifying the culture that the mouse pre-implantation IVF embryos are grown in. So, in the U.S., about 1.5% of newborns are conceived by IVF. Elsewhere, the ratio of in vitro fertilized babies is as high as 4%. The assistive reproductive technology is also extensively used in cows, pigs, livestock breedings of all types, where researchers began documenting this skew toward male offspring. It began in the early 1990s, so as I said, it's been known for a very long time. And in the past decade, the similar sex ratio has been found among human IVF embryos. But supporting evidence for the imbalance has been inconsistent. So lots of people have been looking for why this skewing takes place, but nobody has been able to find the reason for it up till this point. When Tian's group compared X chromosome imprinting in IVF and conceived mouse embryos, they found that expression of the protein ZIST was required for X chromosome inactivation. And that's been actually known for a decade. ZIST is a very well-known gene. It encodes a non-protein-making RNA. It's non-translated. And it coats the inactive X chromosome. And what it does is it attracts a whole series of other proteins that shut down the chromosome. So expression of both ZIST and its regulatory protein was impaired in female IVF embryos. But it doesn't affect the males because they're not turning off one of their chromosomes. So male mice were born to IVF more often, and presumably to human IVF implantations as well. Tian was able to rescue ZIST expression in the IVF females by experimentally upregulating the expression of the ZIST regulatory protein. By doing that, they overexpressed ZIST again, and female X chromosome inactivation went back to normal. By overexpressing that gene, they effectively reversed the sex ratio skew among mouse IVF embryos. And they did it simply by adding retinoic acid to the implantation culture media, which upregulated the ZIST expression. Retinoic acid is related to vitamin A in structure and function. Tian says, quote, "Our study not only identifies the mechanism underlying the female-based pregnancy loss and subsequent sex skewing in vitro fertilized offspring, it also resolves the IVF-induced sex skewing by targeting and improving the culture system of the IVF process. Our results provide a roadmap for exploring the mechanism of IVF-associated health complications," unquote. I hate to even bring this up, but this so-called skewing is easy to see and easy to identify, and was pretty easy to treat to get rid of the skewing. But, and this is a big but, this may just be the tip of the iceberg. There may be lots and lots of epigenetic effects occurring because of IVF that we're simply not detecting. There may be much, much broader phenotypic changes from the mainstream that we are going to smack right into in a decade or so when we see IVF babies all growing up. Worse yet, Tian's little experiment should make us very aware that minor changes in the environment of the IVF embryo can lead to all sorts of unexpected results. What we do in the lab has an effect. It's not the same as having a baby the old-fashioned way. I'm not saying get rid of IVF. What I am saying is, when you're playing God, you sure as heck better be prepared for the long-term fallout of that. Of course, we are still talking about mice here, and Tian has yet to actually demonstrate that his treatments will have any effect, or the same effect, on human embryos. By the way, speaking of playing God, I highly recommend Neal Stephenson's new novel, Seven Eves. The story actually takes a while to start taking up a major theme of genetics and epigenetics and how it could affect the human race in the direst of circumstances. But as usual, Stephenson does an incredible job of world building, and the story itself gets moving right away, even though Stephenson is more than a bit long-winded. You not only learn about genetics, epigenetics, and terraforming to quite an extent, but you also learn more than you'll ever want to know about orbital mechanics. Anyway, just a thought, it's a really good book. It's also very long, as most Neal Stephenson books are. Next story, Perfect Pitch. I had a conversation with one of my colleagues a few weeks back that reminded me how complex humans can be. My colleague is a neurobiologist, but also a musician. Somehow we got to talking about perfect pitch. And he told me about neurological studies where they discovered humans with perfect pitch who grew up with mistuned pianos. Apparently, that does end perfect pitch completely because you learn the wrong pitch, and apparently it stays with you for the rest of your life, so that if you have perfect pitch, it's never actually perfect. It's only relative to what you learned as a kid growing up, and apparently it really messes up your ability to be a very good musician. Anyway, I thought it was interesting when I came across this new paper in the Journal of Neuroscience from Dr. Lutz Jahnke of the University of Zurich. And it's entitled, Bridging the Gap Between Perceptual and Cognitive Perspectives on Absolute Pitch. It examines exactly the phenomenon that I was talking about with my colleague. So the ability to identify pitches does vary from person to person. Not in the sense of tuning an instrument or matching a tone, but in the sense of hearing a pitch and naming it correctly, like C or F sharp, or singing a specific tone on command without using any reference note. That's absolute pitch. Early explanations of the neuroscience behind absolute pitch relied on what psychologists call categorical perception. That's where the left auditory related cortex, the ARC, was thought to process and organize incoming tones, innately assigning them as they were received without conscious effort. Later, there were hypotheses that suggested an idea called pitch labeling. In this case, people with absolute pitch were thought to rely on memories of matching tones heard in the past, which is what I was referring to early on with the mistuned piano thing. In any case, the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, DLPFC, and the left arcuate fasciculus brain regions were thought to be responsible for this. Jahnke says, both theories make completely different statements regarding the moment and the anatomical location of the special processing, and there is evidence to support both theories, unquote. Absolute pitch is rare, occurring in only about 1% of the population, but it's associated with excellent musical ability, and it does show up to 20% of musicians. So Jahnke turned to musicians to explore how absolute pitch functions in the brain. The team recruited musicians with and without absolute pitch, and they used electroencephalography to evaluate the connection between the left ARC and the DLPFC. Jahnke found significantly increased activity in musicians with absolute pitch, indicating that these brain regions are tightly connected in those individuals. In fact, detecting the particular electrophysiological marker for 3 minutes was predictive of absolute pitch in the volunteers. Jahnke states, quote, this coupling enables an especially efficient exchange of information between the auditory cortex and the dorsal frontal cortex in people with absolute pitch, which means that the perception and memory information can be exchanged quickly and efficiently, unquote. While this study demonstrates how the two prevailing hypotheses for absolute pitch processing work together, it also opens the door for further studies on auditory processing and memory, potentially even leading to ideas for treatment of some hearing impairments. And frankly, I think the fact that learning the wrong pitch as a child can lead to relative perfect pitch certainly supports the latter theory, which depends on perception and memory to support identification of pitch. Next story. Do you want to make a bunch of money for participating in some seriously gross research? Unarguably, there have been some strange weight loss methods over the years, but swallowing somebody else's frozen poop definitely tops the charts. And no, that's not how you get the money, strangely enough, and sad as that sounds. A new report in the British Medical Journal suggests that there is strong evidence that the gut microbiome of humans, or microbiota, found in feces, have a powerful influence over our bodies. What's more, previous research has shown that poop pills in animals can actually be more effective than antibiotics. What about that quick money I was talking about? Well, Open Biome is a nonprofit organization based in Massachusetts that's looking for chronically thin people willing to donate their stool. They will pay $40 per donation. And there's a $50 bonus if you can donate 5 times a week. So if you made the time to stick with it for a year, you could make $13,000, which isn't bad just for pooping. The poop pill trial for weight loss will also be run by researchers at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and the trial will be controlled and randomized. These stool donors will be carefully screened to make sure that they and their samples are as healthy as possible. Seriously, I don't think it's possible for anybody to be healthy enough for me to ingest their poop, but whatever. This is the kind of trial where I could only wish that I was getting the placebo if I was involved. However, the researchers are hopeful that they will get plenty of volunteers. Dr. Elaine Yu of Mass Gen Hospital and the PI says, quote, fecal microbiota transplantation, FMT, transfers intestinal bacterial by a stool transplant from a healthy, lean person to a person with obesity. Our previous research has suggested that bacteria from poop donor pills can fight infections rooted in the digestive system of a recipient. We will now be testing if the poop could offer a feasible option for weight loss treatments in the future by changing the microbiome of the recipients, unquote. The stool samples from the thin, healthy donors will be freeze-dried, and then 21 obese patients will swallow the pills during the course of the trial, which will last several months and potentially continue for a year or more. The patients will be asked to maintain their regular eating habits and health habits. You and her colleagues hope that the findings will provide more information about the potential of the freeze-dried poop pill. She says, quote, we have no idea what the result will be, but whether it works or not, we'll be able to learn more about how the microbes in our bodies affect us, unquote. The results will certainly be interesting, but above all, bravo to the brave study participants who will voluntarily consume poop pills in the name of science. Last story of the night. I spend a large proportion of my time in teaching genetics classes, explaining all the potentially horrid things that can go wrong with heredity and even with your genetics after you're born. And it's a very long list of nasty things. However, a new paper in the most recent issue of the journal Science by Dr. David Van Heel of Queen Mary University suggests that humans and animals can lose genetic activity quite often and still get along just fine. Van Heel and company examined 3,222 British people with Pakistani heritage carrying on average 140 gene mutations that stop some genes from working. They examined these people's exomes, that's the small portion of the genome that actually encodes protein, and revealed that among a subset of 821 participants, a total of 781 genes were rendered obsolete by loss-of-function mutations. These genes include 422 that scientists did not know that people could live without and still be alive and healthy. Previous studies had indicated that some genes are commonly missing in healthy people. Van Hiel's new study suggests that even rare mutations that disable both copies of a gene, which scientists thought would be associated with diseases because you lose activity entirely and become a homozygous mutant, well, apparently they're not always a problem. Van Hiel's colleagues in England and the U.S. compared health records of 638 people in the study who have rare mutations that abolish both copies of one or more genes, and they looked at records from 1,524 people without the rare mutations. Those with the rare mutations were more likely to have health issues than those without the mutations, the researchers found. Now here's the serious kicker, which threw me for a loop. Even really important genes may go missing, apparently without any harm. One woman had mutations in the PRDM9 gene, which is important during the formation of eggs and sperm. Without the mouse version of the gene, mice are sterile. Now, dogs have a fallback mechanism to compensate for losing a gene. However, the woman with this mutation, which should have made her sterile, had a child, indicating that she is fertile. So humans, like canids, must have a way to compensate for the missing gene too, although it appears to be different than the dog's pathway for fixing the problem. Van Hiel says, quote, "The problem of compensatory mechanisms has never really come up before. There's a phenotype and there's a genotype, and we know the loss of a set of alleles leads to a disease state. However, these mechanisms that help compensate for the complete loss of certain genes could in the long run complicate the search for genes responsible for rare genetic diseases," unquote. In short, what this means is that we still don't understand what the heck is going on in genomes. We understand how proteins are made, we understand a lot of control mechanisms, but we also are completely ignorant of lots and lots of stuff. And this just continues to remain a mystery for our understanding of not only animal genetics and genetics of other organisms, but certainly of humans as well. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Avoid ingesting poop pills at all costs. Always make sure your piano is in perfect tune for the sake of your children. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.